From the KTOO Newsroom in Juneau, I'm Yvonne Cormery. Candidates for the Juneau Assembly and School Board shared their views on education funding, staff retention, and whether to build a new city hall yesterday. KTOO's Katie Anastas reports.
Two candidates are running for each district assembly seat. Joe Geldof is running against incumbent Alicia Hughes-Gandies for District 1. David Morris is running against incumbent Christine Wall for District 2. At Thursday's forum, hosted by the Juneau Chamber of Commerce, they discussed City Hall, turnover at the hospital, and the need for more housing. The city is asking voters to fund a new City Hall through a $27 million bond. District 1 candidate Joe Geldof said it would be a misuse of public funds.
There's a lot of talk here among the Assembly and the community about housing, housing, housing. So what are we going to do? We're going to build a new City Hall.
But incumbent Alicia Hughes-Gandies said repairing a building that doesn't fit all city workers doesn't make financial sense. The city would still have to rent other office space.
Speaking of housing, some of the space we're renting could be returned to residential apartments.
Candidates also discussed turnover among Bartlett Regional Hospital leadership. Last month, Bartlett CEO David Keith announced his retirement, and CFO Sam Wise announced his resignation. Incumbent Christine Wall said the assembly needs to support the city-owned hospital's board.
We're lucky to have a strong and stable board for Bartlett right now, but we always have challenges recruiting members to serve on public boards in the city, and so we need to keep making sure that we have engaged citizens willing to serve on that board.
Wall's opponent, David Morris, agreed that the assembly should work closely with the board. But he said he doesn't think the city should be running a hospital.
The city should not have a hospital. I think it should be privatized.
School board candidates were also at the forum. Three candidates are vying for two seats. Candidate David Noon emphasized the need for more state funding so the district can recruit and retain teachers.
If schools are underperforming, one of the reasons that they're underperforming is that we have not received adequate funding from the legislature for years.
When asked how the district should decide which books should be available in libraries, candidate Brittany Chione Haywood said she was happy with the board's current policies.
One of the things about reading is you really need to connect with it. And so having those options for all children is important.
Paige Sipniewski said she thinks parents should have a say in what books are available in school libraries.
I am completely against anything regarding gender, sex, religion, profanity, drug use, race, as far as literature for kids in school.
The forum was the latest in a series of public events featuring municipal candidates. Local media, including KTOO, will co-host forums on Tuesday and Wednesday at 6 p.m. The chamber will host an area-wide candidate forum on Thursday. In Juneau, I'm Katie Anastas.
A new study suggests that booming hatchery populations could increase the risk of salmon suffocation in rivers and streams across southeast Alaska. As conditions get hotter and drier due to climate change, scientists believe hatchery strays could create overcrowded, smothering conditions and put wild salmon at risk. KTOO's Anna Canny has the story.
In 2013, researcher Chris Sargent was doing some routine water quality monitoring in Sitka's Indian River when he noticed the oxygen levels in the water were unusually low.
Pretty much lethal, getting close to zero.
Fish started dying off, and many of them were hatchery-raised pinks. Sargent developed a hypothesis.
Too many salmon breathing too much oxygen, and it's unnaturally high population because of these stray hatchery fish.
A new study by Sargent and his research team suggests that across southeast Alaska, straying hatchery salmon could put pressure on wild salmon habitat that's already vulnerable due to climate change. The water in rivers and streams has dissolved oxygen in it, which salmon and other fish breathe through their gills. When those fish can't get enough oxygen, it's known as hypoxia. It can suffocate spawning salmon. Or it can slow them down on their trip upstream.
They may not make the spawning grounds in time or have enough time to spawn. So there's a lot of really subtle effects in addition to just massive die-offs that might happen.
Since the 70s, hatchery production across Alaska has grown, especially for pink and chum salmon. Hundreds of millions of fish are released each year. They're supposed to return to their hatchery when they spawn, but they commonly stray into wild streams. According to the study's authors, that puts wild salmon at a higher risk of hypoxia. Many southeast rivers and streams already face low oxygen due to human-caused climate change. Hotter water holds less oxygen, and when warming temperatures come along with drought, that makes things even worse, because an ideal salmon habitat is rough and fast-flowing. That kind of water is oxygen-rich.
The more the water tumbles and foams, the more opportunity it has to exchange with the atmosphere, so that tumbling motion of the water is basically injecting oxygen.
Climate change could slow stream flows by bringing drought to Southeast Alaska. Extreme rainstorms may be punctuated by longer dry periods, especially in the summer. And declining mountain snowpack could cause drought, too. Ryan Belmore is a U.S. Forest Service researcher who co-authored the study. He said, abundant winter snow feeds watersheds as it melts gradually throughout the spring and summer. Without it, salmon streams could dry up and slow down in the summer heat.
We're moving towards a condition where more of our watersheds are likely going to be more prone to this.
According to the study, more than 10,000 miles of Southeast salmon streams are primed for hypoxia, which means those cramped conditions could strangle even more wild salmon. In Juneau, I'm Anna Canny.
Celebrated climbers Alex Honnold and Tommy Caldwell summited Devil's Thumb in late August, but they couldn't pull it off without the counsel of a local climber who's had a decades-long love affair with the mountain. KFSK's Shelby Herbert has the story on Dieter Close, who's passing the torch on to the next generation of legendary climbers.
Standing outside his little cabin on the edge of the rainforest, Dieter Close gazes out at the ocean. He built this place in the shadow of the giant rock. On this day, a wall of fog blocks his view, but Close knows exactly what's behind those clouds.
It looks just like a German beer stein. It's a little wider at the bottom, so it doesn't tip over when you're drunk. There's only room for one person at the top, and you can just barely stand if you have the courage.
Close stood there himself, twice. He can't even count how many unsuccessful climbs it took. His best guess is a dozen. He's the only person to make it halfway up the unclimbed northwest face and come back alive. Close has been climbing since he was a kid. He moved to Petersburg in 1982. At first, he lived behind a cemetery in a borrowed tent.
It got torn up by a bear, and a friend of mine told me, hey, there's a boat for sale for $200. And I thought, great, and I'll get to look at Devil's Thumb.
Close says it wasn't love at first sight or first summit. His enchantment with the mountain grew over the course of his life.
It had everything I wanted from mountains, everything that satisfied me by climbing. It's difficult by any side, and it's not super high altitude, which is great. You're totally alone, and it's a wild-looking thing.
Close is a home builder by trade. He hurt his back at work a few years ago. The injury all but ended his climbing career. But he's still known to climbers in the region as the godfather of the Stikine ice caps.
I mean, Dieter is, he's key to anybody who comes here to climb.
That's world-class climber Tommy Caldwell. He came up north recently to climb Devil's Thumb and shoot a documentary about it. Dieter advised him and his climbing partner, Alex Honnold.
I mean, there's just nobody else that knows nearly as much about the Devil's Thumb.
Yeah.
He's like the local custodian. He's like managing the mountain.
Close helped draft their route. It tags every peak up and down the whole massif, over the twin summits of the Witch's Towers, the slender Cat's Ears Spires, and then the looming cathedral of Devil's Thumb itself. Caldwell says those features were as wicked as the sound of their names.
All of the summits are, like, incredibly pointy. Yeah, you climb up it and you're sitting on the summit and there's, like, thousands and thousands of feet drop on either side of you. It's one of the more, like, exposed-feeling summits I've ever seen in my life.
Hours before they left Alaska, both climbers came by to write in a book that Dieter Close keeps about the mountain. It contains the names of everybody to ever summit in living history. Alex and Tommy sketched out a map of their route that took up two whole pages. Back in front of his cabin, Close gazes across the sound. He says the view is actually better from down here.
You're not necessarily enjoying yourself on difficult climbs. You're getting tired and thirsty, hungry, all of that. And it's not until you get back into the valley and look up at that mountain, and then you get some real joy out of it.
Climbing Devil's Thumb today would be difficult for him, but Dieter Close says he still dreams about one last summit. In Petersburg, I'm Shelby Herbert.
It's 55 degrees here in Juneau. This is KTOO.